Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to have a conversation with a first-time novelist, at least first-time published novelist. A very interesting book came across our desk called Woods Burner by John Pipkin. John grew up here in our sweet city of Baltimore and has written this novel based on a fire that Henry David Thoreau set and burned down the woods near Concord, Massachusetts, which he didn't write about too much later. And John Pipkin took this event and created a world out of it. And John Pipkin, welcome. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. This is amazing. This is, as we were talking before, your debut novel, but as with many our writers, this is not your first novel.
Yes, I think it happens that way for many writers, although we all try to lie to ourselves when we're in the process of writing that first book, because no one wants to think that it's going to be nothing more than a learning process. But for many writers, there's the first novel, and then there's the novel that actually is the first novel published.
But now this is it's an amazing book. I mean, it's really well written. I mean, it's one of those things
you could have
written that could really have been boring as hell. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I know exactly what you're saying. Yes.
But it's just amazing, these characters you've developed to kind of flesh out this moment of 1844 in American history, whether it's Thoreau or Caleb or Osmond or two of my favorites, Anesky and Zelenka.
Yes, right.
And the others. Talk a little bit about what you did to consume this period, to kind of put yourself in this world.
Well, you know, I did struggle with the realization early on that it could be very easy to write an incredibly dull book about this event. Since my first thoughts were, well, I'm interested in Thoreau, and I would be perfectly happy to write 300 pages entirely inside Thoreau's head and then have something that no one else would want to read except for perhaps my mother. So I realized I needed to try to find a way to show people what is fascinating about Thoreau at this point in his life and also what was fascinating about America and American history at this point in the nation's development. And so in order to do that, I try to develop characters who would each reflect a different aspect of American culture and American society at this point in its development. And what wound up happening is the same thing that drew me to Thoreau at this point in his life was very similar to what drew me to this period in American history. For Thoreau in 1844, in many ways, he was at a crossroads. You could already see the ambitions that would lead him to become the Henry David Thoreau that we know today. Mm-hmm. So he already had interest in possibly going off and living alone somewhere. He already had taken the trip down the Concord and Merrimack Rivers and made notes, but hadn't written that up yet. And that, of course, would be his first major work.
With his brother that he went.
Exactly, right. And his brother died several years before this fire takes place. So there's also this grief over the death of his brother and his inability to sit down and work those notes into a book. And so there was this sense that Thoreau had entered a kind of creative malaise. So he had in some way his professional life had stalled. And as I began looking at American culture in 1844 to try to find a way to capture or describe what it was like to be an American, what did it mean to be part of this young nation in 1844, it seemed like in some ways there was a similar feeling in America. The great event of the American Revolution was now fading into the past. The tensions that would result in the Civil War were already present, and the Civil War, the possibility that some terrible conflict was coming, was beginning to loom on the horizon. But at the same time, Americans still seem to be searching for a sense of themselves. What is America? What is this great experiment? And it seems no surprise that it's around this time, I believe it's 1839, maybe 37, that Emerson delivers the American Scholar Address, in which he begins calling upon other Americans to start to begin writing American literature, to begin developing American art and American philosophy, in a sense, to begin developing American culture. So it felt like this was also a period for America where here is this here's this nation, this young nation with great promise, looking for its own mythologies. We already see the sort of seeds of the American dream, but people are still wondering, well, what is that going to be? What are we going to do with this potential? And so that seemed to create a nice parallel between Thoreau's own life and the American.
And your books, there are a lot of subtexts here.
Hopefully.
In your book.
I hope so.
Lots. And one of them is this battle over the American dream, over identifying what America is, what it means to be an American. What's our philosophy? What's our spirituality? What's our view of the world? Is it mercantile? Is it spiritual? Is it artistic? I mean, the contradictions. Do we tear down the woods? I mean, to build cities, businesses. I mean, this is you see America in 1844 as a period of time when it's not unlike our own world in some ways, but in a struggle with itself.
Yes,
over its own definition.
Right, and you know there are more parallels with the present time that have emerged.
I kept thinking
since,
about that through the book, but the parallels, yeah.
Right, I mean, Thoreau himself grew up in a period of great financial recession. America had gone through a terrible financial crisis as a young man, and there are some scholars who even speculate that his kind of penny-pinching ways and the way he documents everything he spends comes from having grown up in a financial environment where money was very tight. And you know, America, you know, suffered greatly from the embargoes during the War of 1812. And so, again, there were these a discourse that you hear now about we need to be more independent. We need to find ways to, you know, rely on our own resources. So I think there were parallels there as well.
But John Pipkin wrote this novel, Woods Burner, which is what we're talking about right now. It's a novel about built around Henry David Thoreau and the burning down of the Concord's woods, which he did by accident.
Yes.
I mean, here he stumbles into these woods and burns this thing down, and his reaction is so interesting, the way you perceive his reaction to be.
Well, it's interesting reading his own accounts of this event. I guess most people are familiar with Thoreau's famous journals, which he had begun in the late 1830s, but in 1843, 1844, his entries become very sparse, many blank pages, and he does not write about the fire at the time that it occurs.
That's what 6 years later, right?
6 years later, yes. Right. In 1850, he finally writes about it, and in sort of classic Thoreauvian ways, where you can see him struggling with the guilt and shame over having done this, but then at the same time becoming very defensive about, you know, well, why should he feel guilty? Because he hadn't really done anything unnatural. Fire is a part of nature, and it was consuming its natural food. And then begins to rail against, you know, the people who claim that they could actually own, privately own the woods. And so, you know, he can't possibly be destroying private possessions that no man has any right to own to begin with. So you see this real, you know, psychic struggle, you know, between feeling guilty and feeling outraged and being defensive. And
well, I mean, it is part of the – I mean, I thought about that issue when he came upon the farmer after he burned down the woods and the whole struggle they had over the question of my property.
Right.
Don't bother me. The fire's not on my property. I don't want to talk to you. But the battle even at that moment with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson and others who created this transcendentalist movement and the magazine, The Dial, that Thoreau worked for that you write about.
Yes, right.
Their whole battle with private property and what it meant. And should people actually own a piece of land? Can it really be theirs? And the kind of our own American Indian kind of past and present being involved in that philosophical discussion over what this land meant.
Right. Right, and there were already concerns at that time, environmental concerns about what was happening to the land and the deforestation that was taking place. I think few people realize that if you visit Walden Pond today, there are actually
it's a shopping
more
center.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, our first reaction is to think, well, look at how developed Walden Pond is now. But actually, there are more trees at Walden today than there were at Thoreau's time.
Massachusetts is the most heavily forested state in the nation.
Yes,
I read the other day,
and that is
that's
due,
amazing.
Yeah, that is due to intentional efforts to reforest the land. So you know, actually, there were fewer trees at Thoreau's time than we see today. Because the cities were growing, agriculture was spreading. People were cutting down the woods for well, for commercial use, and again, to sort of think of America in 1844, the land just seemed infinite. I mean, there were so many trees. The resources were so great. It's hard for the human mind to make a distinction between vastness and infiniteness.
Well, that's, I mean, one of the subtexts in this book is the battle with Thoreau over, is it really wrong to, he hated what he did. It bothered him what he did by accident burning down all these woods and maybe burning down the city of Concord. But he was kept saying to himself, but they chop these woods down. They destroy our woods to build towns and homes. Mm-hmm. It's no different than me burning down the woods. That's this battle going on.
Right. I was trying to get into the trying to figure out, you know, how would this look to someone who so valued the innate worth of the natural world, and then to see its fragility underscored in this way, that's something that seems, again, infinite and self-sustaining and so vast could be wiped out so quickly and so carelessly. And in fact, you know, I think some insight into that comes from the article the Concord Freeman printed at the time, about 2 days after the fire, in which they said the one lesson to be taken from this is that hopefully future visitors who come to the woods for recreation will not be so careless. We'll watch what they do. And this is, you know, this is all the way back 1844. You know, people are already saying when these city folk come out to the country and want to go on a camping trip, they shouldn't be careless with their matches and their cigarette butts. And
now, did you really allow yourself to be consumed by and assume yourself into the 1840s? Did you spend a lot of time there? Did you spend a lot of time books and language and listening and thinking about did you put yourself back there a lot? Did you stay there a lot?
Well, I tried to do the research as I was writing because I'd learned the hard way in the past that if I do spend a lot of time researching before I write, then the writing turns into a vehicle for trying to cram every little curious fact that I've discovered into the book, and then it becomes kind of a compendium of curiosities about 1844 instead of a story. So I did try to read lots of letters from the period, historical accounts. Thoreau's own writings played very heavily into this to get a sense of the language and the appearance of the area. But at the same time, the research itself sort of paralleled the writing. So as I needed descriptions and settings, I would research those descriptions and settings, but really tried to control myself so that I didn't feel the need to include all kinds of facts and figures.
What I meant was that not so much the facts, and I kept looking at this when I myself notes as I was reading that. Now, is this what you're writing about? Are these the conscious battles, the unconscious battles, the battles for the soul and ideas that they were having in 1844? That's what I meant by that.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, in working with the individual characters, I took the approach that, you know, people are essentially unchanged. You know, many of the, you know, they dress differently, they speak differently. The nation was a different place, the economy was different, but individual people, when it comes to the way that they relate to each other or their, you know, the search for meaning in their lives, the terms may be different, but I think that that essential yearning is the same.
That human struggle is constant.
Yes. And many of, you know, much of what Thoreau writes, I mean, people are familiar with those, with the Thoreau phrases like, you know, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. That seems as applicable today as it did in Thoreau's time. And I think the opposite is true as well. There are many things people struggle with today and are, you know, feel today that people were feeling and struggling with at that time
and
as well.
One of those things in this book was the sexual struggles all through this book.
Well, you know, I think that maybe it's just sort of the natural egotism of human beings that we tend to think that whatever struggle we are experiencing in the here and the now is unique to us and to this period or our own particular time. And, you know, I'm always surprised when I hear people say, you know, things didn't used to be this way.
Right.
Or you know, it was, you know, people seem to have this illusion of a golden era sometime in the past when everything was fine and perfect and people didn't have, you know, existential crises. They weren't suffering from any sort of, you know, confusion about their sexuality or their desires. People didn't have, you know, such overwhelming economic concerns that, you know, no one has ever suffered from economic anxiety the way we are right now in 2009 during the recession. This is unique entirely to us. So I wanted to convey some sense that so many of these concerns, sexual, theological, national, political, economic, really run throughout human history, not just in 1844, but as far back as you can go in recorded human history. Even something like the pornography that Eliot carries in his bookshop. You find it in every single era, and it's always I find it very amusing that as soon as we as humans develop a new form of technology, one of the first things that takes advantage of
is porno.
It's pornography. It's out on the internet as soon as we come up with it, and it's out there. You can go back and look at engravings.
And you really described how these were made.
Yeah.
In the book. I find that part of that interesting. You kind of put yourself back into a world where you described how things were made, whether it was these porno cars or whether it was the pencils that Thoreau and his family made. That's what they did for a living. You got into the kind of minutiae, not in a boring way either, but into how these things were created.
Yes, well,
I like that stuff.
Well, I thought it was, you know, it's always interesting, I think, to look at the tangible, concrete elements of people's lives, especially if we're dealing with a figure like Thoreau, who has this sort of iconic status as an intellectual. And I think people just assume, well, he must have been above having to make a living.
No, he was an inventor. He made – I had no idea all the things he made.
Yes, exactly. He actually – and I think there's a possibility that, you know, he could have just gone on to be America's greatest pencil maker instead of an iconic environmentalist. But his father was regarded as one of the best pencil makers in America at this time, since American pencils were seen as inferior to European pencils.
Right. They wanted a Thoreau pencil.
Right.
What was the other pencil that the one that we all used in school that you mentioned?
Oh,
pencil manufacturer.
The Dixon?
Dixon.
Yes, right.
I had no idea. The Dixon pencil was actually a pencil from...
It was, yes. Yeah. The biggest problem, from what I understand, with American pencils at the time is that there was no consistency to the lead. So when it was cold, the lead would be brittle and crumbly. And when the weather got hot, they'd get sort of greasy and runny and smudgy.
But not the Thoreau pencil.
No, and that's it's due largely to two things. Thoreau's maternal uncle, Charles Dunbar, discovered what was called the Cumberland, I think, load up in New Hampshire, which was a load of plumbago. And this was a high-quality graphite they could use in the pencils. And Henry David Thoreau went to the Harvard Library one day and did some research on pencil-making formulas and found a forgotten formula for mixing Bavarian clay with graphite in this.
And you describe it all.
And that's, yeah. That's,
I love that. I mean, who knew that Thoreau did all this stuff?
Right, right.
And I guess, you know, when you have Thoreau, going back to the sexual thing for me, we have Thoreau, his line was he knows that the insatiable yearning for a physical touch so confounds heart and mind as to reduce a man to animal bewilderment, a dog chasing its tail. You're right. It's that the sexual struggles that people had, the repression of that era.
Right.
Well, we have repression this year as well, but I mean, you know, but that people were so sexually repressed, like Odman. I mean, his struggle around sexuality or the what happened to the two women. It was amazing pieces you decided to bring to us for this.
Well, thanks. Well, I was trying to convey a sense that maybe the only difference is that people didn't talk about these issues then as much as they do
now. They kept them to themselves.
They kept them to themselves. But even in our modern era, I think the endless talk about sexuality that we have today and what would seem to be
it never stops.
Almost infinite outlets hasn't in any way alleviated, you know, so much of the frustration.
We're still obsessed by it. We're still obsessed.
Yes, right. I hope that people are happier now, but I don't know.
I'm not sure we are. But, We're as obsessed as we always were, I think, but I don't know if we're any happier.
Yeah, I think the tension and the anxiety and the struggle to deal with that is the same now as it has ever been.
What's important about this conversation in some senses is that when artists, novelists, as you kind of put this on the page, it allows people to realize that they're not alone in their struggles around sexuality, around obsessions, around thinking about it, being part of it. I mean, because that's what you do as novelists, isn't it? You go into our heads and kind of try to put it on page to give us a sense of who we are.
Right, right. And you know, for someone like Odman, he is isolated not only by his sexual desire, but by the fact that he is an immigrant and he's struggling to fit into the new world. He's here without a family.
What a struggle
he's here on
he
his
went
own.
My God.
I was trying to, you know, we have so much mythology built about the promise of America and the immigrant experience. And I was wondering, what would it really be like, 1844, to be a young boy left on the shores of this
alone.
New country, alone, without even the power of language to relate to the people who are there. And you have to reinvent yourself from the start, and then add to that all of the other tensions that you deal with as a human being.
And one of the other things, whether it's Odman or Eliot, the entrepreneur, would-be playwright, or Thoreau himself, or almost all the characters, really, that you created for us, is their struggle to find space, their struggle to find solitude. That's another part of this human condition you kind of push almost in every page.
Right. I wondered how much of especially comparing people's perceptions of civilization in Europe as compared to the New World in America, what that represented for them. You know, it represents, you know, opportunity, certainly, and the chance to begin again, to reinvent yourself. But there is also the lure, even today, of the solitude that open spaces has for Americans, this idea of the frontier, always pushing the frontier and going out and, you know, seeking new land and new opportunity. And I think solitude is a big part of that.
Even the solitude inside your head.
Right, right.
I mean, that's part of what's going on here too.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking with John Pipkin and his marvelous new novel, first novel, his premier novel, Woods Burner. It is on Nantelis Press, which is Doubleday, and it's a novel built around the time that Henry David Thoreau, one of our icons, burned down these woods in Massachusetts, and he has built a world around that he takes us through, and of these characters. So I'm going to assume that when you developed all these characters, and Caleb, the kind of religious fundamentalist trying to find his way, and Aneska and Zelenka and Emma, the Irish immigrant, and all these people. Did you, when you wrote about them as a writer, did you write about them first? Like, did you write all their parts first and then go back to figure out how to put them together? How did you create these characters?
That's exactly what I did.
You did
actually.
That.
I did. When I sat down and was mapping this out, and people are sometimes alternately surprised and or horrified to find out that I kind of mapped it out in an Excel spreadsheet when I first sat down because things were beginning to get away from me and confusing, and I thought, if I'm going to, you know, keep these stories straight and
you have some
them,
organization somehow.
Somehow. Then. So there was the option of doing a kind of grease pencil outline on the wall of the room, or doing it in spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet seemed to keep it more organized. But I did. I looked at the characters and decided that In order to make sure that I stayed focused on their developments throughout the story, which involved telling quite a bit of backstory and then bringing them up to the moment where they encounter this fire that takes place for only a day in 1844, that in order to keep a consistency in their stories, I would write each story from start to finish first. Mm-hmm. So I wrote Thoreau's story from start to finish, like a novella, I guess, and then did the same thing for Odman Huss and Eliot Calvert and for Caleb Doughty. So the minor characters like Aneska and Zelenka and Emma had their shorter stories. And then I went back and broke them up and interwove them and rewrote the novel again from start to finish to
and wove their lives together in these ways, how they touched, and
yes,
which I like a lot. But, you know, even your – it's funny. The major characters are men. Your minor characters, many of them are women. But I didn't find them to be minor characters. I mean,
right, and they actually grew over time. I guess I still refer to them as minor characters since that is how they began in the writing. But as the story grew and as I rewrote the interwoven stories, Emma began to take on a much larger role, as did Aneska and Zelenka as well. Their stories began to develop and expand and become more interwoven.
Great stories. I mean, I really love the women in this book.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, there's something about them. And you're making a very heavy-set woman, a woman of girth, to be so sensual and sexual, which I found a rarity in the way we look at those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some of that comes from a bit of research that I had done that had said that the...
Especially in the white world, it's very weird.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
In other cultures, in other places, it's not as that women who are heavy are still very sensual and sexual beings. But in our kind of crazy Madison Avenue world, we've taken that away.
Right. Well, and I wanted to come up with a love story, I guess, that didn't follow a sort of stereotypical plot line or the narrative that we're used to seeing, particularly out of Hollywood movies, where we're shown at the start the beautiful man and the beautiful woman, and then wondering how are they going to wind up together, because this is certainly fated to happen.
It's a great story. I love that. That's a wonderful piece of this. And the other part is it's obviously about fire. This whole thing is built around the power and almost conscious nature of fire. But there's so many pieces of burning in this, whether it's Eliot's play or part of Oddman's life. I mean, fire is big here. I mean, it's not just the woods. You have fire everywhere.
Right, right. There are different ways that fire really began to work its way into the other characters' lives. I think mainly because they all are. Well, it's hard to talk about this without falling into puns. They're all smoldering, looking for a spark.
So, before I ask you more about just another piece of this. As a writer, I mean, it might sound like a silly question, but how and where did you learn to write this way? I mean, the idea of what words mean a lot to you, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you love the word and kind of stringing these ideas together. I mean, tell me about how you got into writing like this. Where did your writing come from?
Well, really, and I always tell my students this when I teach.
Because you teach where University of Texas?
Well, I'm actually teaching at a university just north of Austin called Southwestern University.
I'm teaching some creative writing
classes this fall. I always tell my students that there are really only two ways to learn how to write. One is by reading, and the other is by writing.
Right.
There are many, many books out there that talk about, you know, different ways to brainstorm and outline and tap into your creative self. And they're all useful in their own way. But at the end of the day, the only way to really learn how to write, whether it's poetry or short fiction or a novel, is to read poetry and short fiction and novels and see what other writers have done and how they've done it, and to turn your reading into a form of study. So, you know, if I was trying to work on a flashback, for example, I would read, you know, novels that contained flashbacks.
And there's a lot of flashbacks here.
Right, and then back up and see, well, how did these writers do it? How did they pull it off?
Because your flashbacks and daydreaming are huge in this book.
Mm-hmm.
All your major characters daydream like crazy.
Right. They're all stuck in their heads.
You know, but the daydreaming is, I think, also is that the interesting thing to realize as a novelist, that that's what we do as people.
Right.
Everyone is a daydreamer.
I think everyone, regardless of their careers or the lives they've chosen, they're walking around with with novels of their lives unfolding in their head all day long. They're the narratives people are constantly telling themselves to explain to themselves where they are and who they are and how they've gotten there and where they wanted to go and where they'd rather be or where they might have been.
And, and that's all part of the subtext, where you might have been, how cause and effect change our lives, as Thoreau talks about in your book, in your novel. And but it comes to all these characters that cause and effect.
I've always been very interested in trying to map cause and effect, not only in individual lives, but in the sweep of history, and in the sense that we naturally want to see very clear lines of, you know, this caused this. You know, why did this event, this, you know, tragic historical event happened? It was because of this particular event over here. But I don't. I've never felt that history moves that way, or that individual lives move that way. There are multiple causes that intersect, that produce multiple effects, and there's no way to really trace what one event is going to cause another event. There is so much, you know, capriciousness and chance that intervenes, and our best intentions. Particularly in the case of something like this, Thoreau's only intention was to cook a fish chowder. Our best intentions can result in terrible tragedies.
From fish chowder to burning down a woods and almost destroying an entire town.
Right. And those tragedies themselves will have results of their own that we may judge to be good or bad as history unfolds.
And we'll find out, once you read Woods Burner, you'll find out whether these things are good or bad.
Right.
And what happens to these people. I mean, I love that the characters are also just kind of struggling with their lives. And the other, a couple of very quick things. I mean, it's the other one of your subtext seems to be this battle over the nature of beauty and what beauty really means.
Right.
Whether it's M is beauty, or is a fire beautiful, or Oddman thinking that beauty belongs to whatever is fragile and vulnerable that has to be protected.
Right.
And, you know, you wrestle a lot, have your characters wrestling with this idea of beauty.
Right.
A lot.
Right. And that was something I think that was central to a lot of Thoreau's thinking as well. You know, how do we define beauty? How do we define aesthetics? How do we define what does it mean to be a man or an American or a woman?
Right.
These, you know, basic definitions of of self and art, which you would think at this point in human development we would have settled, but we're still asking.
We're still
talking about them and trying to figure out, you know, what the definitions are for these basic concepts.
Right. And I don't think we ever will. I mean, I think that we didn't talk very much about Caleb, but his battle with transcendentalism, his battle with the fundamentalist religious philosophy versus the love of nature and what that role that plays in our lives, and that letter that his father writes to him. There's a really very powerful things going on here. That was the battle. It still is the battle for the American soul in many ways, religiously.
Right. And there, too, I was trying to get at this notion that people feel that, well, if we look at the role of religion in contemporary society, it seems so, you know, fractured and often so contentious, and people seem to harken back to a simpler time and a simpler age when, you know, everyone was unified in a single belief. And I can't seem to find what that time was,
you know,
when that period was, even in early American culture, 1844, that, you know, people were breaking off into groups and, you know, forming different versions of similar beliefs, and the transcendentalists were introducing a whole new idea into American spiritual life, to the role that nature might play in spiritual beliefs, and even in this time, there was an attempt to found new utopian cultures that maybe we can't reinvent religion and spirituality in our current culture. Current meaning 1844.
Right.
That we need to go out and try to start all over again at Brook Farm or Fruitlands or any of these experimental communities that really were looking at ways to reinvent society. They were doing that already 150 years ago, trying to get it right, trying to do it over again.
And I like the tangential, but in some strange, odd way, central but tangential ways, that race and slavery were in this book, that it was there.
Right.
You couldn't get away from it.
Right.
It was a very well done book. It just keeps you – I couldn't stop – I couldn't stop reading it. I had to keep going.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
It was like I became obsessed. Myself, got to finish this before we met.
Well, even in, you know, even with regards to race and slavery, this was a period where, you know, we from our historical perspective know what's coming. We know what's going to happen. But from their perspective at that time, resistance to slavery is really now just beginning to get ahead of steam. The Underground Railroad has been established, but it really hasn't kicked into high gear yet.
Right.
And the abolitionist movement has started, but really hasn't gotten moving yet. So you can see at this period of time, 1844, the seeds of so much that's going to come, so many transformative events that are going to happen to shape America, but they haven't happened yet. They're just simmering.
So you bring us these incredible characters, all their journeys, how they touch this gigantic fire. Did you know when you were getting your PhD that this is in English literature that you wanted to write? Maybe not this novel, but a novel. Was this novel always this inside of you, kind of burning in a sense to get out?
We just can't get away from the idioms.
Can we? It's terrible.
You know, I think I took probably the longest possible route to being a novelist.
You had to have a baby and get up at 5 o'clock in the morning or something,
right.
4 in the morning, whatever you did.
That's right. I had always wanted to be a writer and be a novelist. And I know the path I took was to go the academic route. And, you know, while I was working on my PhD, it was my intention to become a college professor and teach English and then write. And writing was always something that I guess I was putting off and I was putting off and I was putting off. And so it wasn't until finally I had finished my formal academic training that I started writing fiction on my own, and wrote a novel, as you alluded to at the beginning, that didn't get published but is sitting on a shelf somewhere. And that is where I guess the training took place, was writing that first manuscript. And
so you understand your character, Elliot, but you actually wrote it this time. You wrote it.
Oh, yeah. There's
you
nothing.
You may not have, but you did.
There's nothing of me that leaked into Elliot. No.
That's good. This is just wonderful. This is just an incredible first novel. Just an amazing novel. Woods Burner, John Pipkin. It really is. And I'm glad you grew up in Baltimore. I'm glad you wrote this novel.
Oh, thank you.
For all of us.
Oh, thank you very much.